This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is songwriter, singer, and pianist Regina Spektor. Her latest album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats, debuted at number 3 on the Billboard album chart. Her music's been used in many TV shows and movies, including Grey's Anatomy, How I Met Your Mother, Enlightened, and 500 Days of Summer. Terry spoke with her last Monday. Regina Spektor's life has had a very different trajectory than most singer-songwriters in America. She was born in Russia in 1980, when it was still part of the Soviet Union. As she'll explain, her family emigrated from the Soviet Union to the U.S. in 1989, when the Perestroika reform movement made it possible for many Jews to leave. Spektor's family settled in the Bronx. She was already a serious student of classical music, but one of the things the family had to leave behind was her piano. Earlier this summer, she returned to Russia for the first time for performances in Moscow and St. Petersburg. When she spoke to Terry, they began with the song All the Rowboats from Regina Spektor's latest album.
That's All the Rowboats from Regina Spektor's new album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats. Regina Spektor, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
What I love about the song is that percussive rhythm behind you. And of course, it's you playing piano. Did the song come to you when you thought of it with that rhythm?
Yeah, a lot of the time when I would write on piano, I would hear a lot of kind of supplementary beats and sounds in my head, and then I was just kind of stuck with just piano and voice until I would go to the studio, and then I would get to kind of take everything that was inside my head and put it into the tangible world and record it using real instruments. And I think that's why a lot of the time I end up sort of simulating in places where I can, like little sounds or almost like placeholders or markers of beats or other instruments. It's just kind of out of necessity because I'm so limited by just singing and playing piano.
When you say inserting beats, do you mean those strange vocal things that you do?
Yeah, the
exactly. Okay. When you want to be, when it's appropriate for the song, you're a very muscular piano player. I assume that comes from all the classical training that you've had, starting from, what, age 6 or something?
Yeah. Yeah, I started from age 6, but it's funny because I think it's not necessarily, in classical music, it's not necessarily a great thing to play that loud. And I've had kind of arguments sometimes with even piano tuners where, you know, sometimes the way that I need to play the instrument is it gets so loud that the strings reverberate in a certain way, and then it gets kind of a metallic thing. And I always want them to work a lot on the voicing and to soften a lot of the times the hammers, and they get kind of argumentative with me, and they're like, you're not supposed to be playing this loud. And then, you know, I tell them that I have to play how I play, you know. And so it's not necessarily that part of me, maybe, is much more the coming from like the punk and the rock and roll side than the classical side, I guess.
I want to play a song that I think is a really nice contrast to All the Rowboats. And this is like a bonus track that's on the bonus track edition of your latest CD. And it's a beautiful song. It's a Russian song. And it's called The Prayer of François Villon. And it's by, you say his name because I'm going to pronounce
Bulat
it.
Bulat Akhundzhava. So, yeah, it's by Bulat Akhundzhava.
Okay. And as we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, you grew up in Russia and moved to the United States when you were 9. What did this songwriter mean to you when you were in Russia? Were you familiar with his work then?
Yeah, when I was growing up, we had basically three types of music in the house. One was the most main kind of music that we listened to was classical music. And then we also listened a lot to the Russian bards like Akhundzhava and Vysotsky and a lot of other singer-songwriters that were, you know, they were sort of usually just a person with a guitar writing very beautiful poetry and singing it by themselves with no orchestration, really. And I really loved that style of music, especially because it was very, very imaginative. A lot of it was stories about the war, a lot of World War II, kind of. I mean, I was so immersed, I think, in the 80s, even as a Soviet kid in World War II, that I sort of was under the impression that it had just happened.
Yeah.
And I got to America, and I was so surprised. Kids my age were just didn't feel like World War II had just happened. And then the third type of music that we had in the house was the Beatles. It was all the kind of British-American stuff that my dad, that was all his doing. He was a great collector of tapes and trading tapes with friends and kind of this underground community of people that loved Western music. And so we had Moody Blues and Queen and all kinds of cool stuff.
So let's hear this Russian song. And before we hear it, tell us what the lyrics are about, because they're in Russian and most of our listeners will not understand them.
Well, they're really beautiful. I don't want to do a crude translation, but approximately, basically, it's a prayer to God, and it's saying, you know, through the different verses, it talks about all the things that he's asking for. He's asking for, you know, the lucky person to have some money and the generous person to have a rest and for the, you know, the fearful person to get some bravery. And he's saying, you know, for the one who is, you know, dying to rule, give him all of the power that he thirsts for, you know. And then at the end of each one, he says, and don't forget about me. And it's really touching. And it starts out with saying, like, as the world is still turning, while there's still light above, give to everyone that which they do not have. And then it goes on to list all the things.
Oh, that's really nice. Okay. So this is Regina Spektor, and it's a bonus track on the bonus track edition of her latest album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats.
Пока земля еще вертится, пока еще ярок свет, Господи, дай ты каждому, чего у него нет. Умному дай голову, трусливому дай коня, дай счастливому денег и не забудь про меня. Пока земля еще вертится, Господи, твоя власть, дай рвущемуся ко власти навлавствоваться в сласть, дай передышку щедрому. И не забудь про меня, Каину дай раскаяние, и не забудь про меня. Я верю,
That's Regina Spektor singing a song by the Russian songwriter Bulat Okudzhava, and it's from her latest album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats. It's really a beautiful melody, and from how you described it and translated it, a beautiful lyric as well. I'm sure you've performed that in the United States, but also in Russia, because you went on a Russian tour over the summer. It was your first time back since leaving when you were 9. How does response to that song compare in Russia and the United States?
Well, you know, I mean, just being in Russia again after 23 years was super intense for me. I sort of spent the whole time I was there just kind of either crying or laughing or both at the same time. It was just very surreal and emotional and incredible experience. So I think just speaking between songs to everyone in Russian and singing songs that contained Russian, the way that the people, it just felt like we were so happy, both me and the audience, to just kind of have this shared language. It was really, really an amazing feeling.
You started piano lessons when you were 6. How did you get so serious about piano at a young age? Were your parents convinced early on that you were a prodigy because you could learn your way around the piano or sound things out on your own really easily?
I'm the complete opposite of what a prodigy is. I'm lazy. I have a really hard time having work ethic, which I think is the main ingredient of anybody who's an actual prodigy. And I have tremendous amounts of equal parts respect and envy of people that have it and people that are that strong-willed, you know. I always loved music and I always loved singing and humming, and I grew up with a piano in the house and my mom playing it and my parents just loving music, and I was always asking them to put on records and cassette tapes, and there was always time for music, and I would listen to hours and hours of it on the record player and in the cassette tape player in every possible way, and they would take me to concerts, and my life was just filled with music.
So when you were 9, your family decided to leave the Soviet Union. And this was during the period of perestroika, when President Mikhail Gorbachev was leading a reform movement within the country. So how did that enable the family to leave, and why did the family decide to take advantage of the new openness?
Well, it was a really exciting time because Soviet Union had opened its doors for some Jews to leave in the late 70s. And then closed them back up again. And besides all the obvious things like, you know, lack of certain human rights and freedoms, no freedom of religion, all kinds of things like that, it was also just on top of all of that, it was very anti-Semitic place to be. And openly anti-Semitic, kind of as an institution. So in your passport, it was stamped that you're a Jew and, you know, you would not be allowed into certain schools if they had too many Jews, and sometimes they'd decide 5 Jews is too many Jews. So as soon as the ability to apply for a visa was sort of presented, my parents right away applied, because I think they'd wanted to leave earlier, but then it closed. And so as soon as it was open again, they really wanted to take me out of there and have me sort of grow up in a different situation.
So being a Jew meant that you were going to be discriminated against in many ways. What else did it mean? Did you were you observant at all? Did you feel much of a, you know, Jewish identity outside of the negative things that were projected on you?
I mean, that's interesting because to me, I think that because I grew up kind of surrounded with the negative stuff more so, I had this strong feeling of pride and identity as a Jew, even from being very little. But there wasn't really any kind of like religious, you couldn't go to synagogue, you couldn't do stuff like that. But we did have little relics of religion sort of passed down here and there. Like My grandmother, my mom's mom, would always make sure that we knew when Passover was, and she would somehow get through a connection of a connection. We would have matzah, and so she would make, you know, chicken soup with matzah balls. But then we would have bread alongside that because we didn't know that you're not supposed to eat bread. So things were sort of like kind of half. They were kind of half superstition, half tradition, half hearsay. And when we got to the Bronx, and it was the first time that we were kind of immersed in the kind of Jewish religious community and started going to synagogue and started going to Jewish school, then we learned, you know, what things actually were. And it was sort of be like, oh, wow, we were kind of doing it, but mostly wrong.
So when you came to the United States, when you moved to the Bronx, you didn't have a piano, couldn't afford one. You were able to use the piano in the basement of the neighborhood synagogue. And then there's a great story about how you found the woman who became your piano teacher. Your father actually met the man who was the husband of the woman who became your piano teacher. So tell the story of how your father met this man and how his wife became your teacher.
Well, my dad really didn't want to stay on any kind of government help. So he got this minimum wage job at night developing photographs at this big company. And he was coming back from there on the subway one night, and he saw a man with a violin case between his feet and an older man. And he started talking, and he heard that he had a Yiddish accent, and they kind of, you know, got to a little bit more talking. And my dad said that he had played violin in his youth, and my mom was a piano professor, and that they had a kid, and she had studied piano, and how we haven't been to hear any classical music for a long time, and that we're really fans of classical music as a family. And he said, well, why don't you come over to our house and we could play you, me and my wife, she's a pianist, and we can play you our program because we're going on tour to Spain to play duets. So me and my whole family, we got dressed up and we went up the hill and we went to their house, and their house was just incredible. It was full of love and books and art and pianos and cats and dogs and just the best kind of vibe you could picture. Just a true art partnership between this husband and this wife. And they played us their program, and then I asked very rudely if Sonia Vargas is the wife and Samuel Martyr is the husband, and I asked if Sonia would be my teacher, and she said of course. So from that moment on, she taught me and my cousin Marcia until we were grown up. And we came and practiced at her house. And then as the time went on, people gifted us a piano, first to my family and then to Marcia's family. And we practiced at home.
Did she make you audition before agreeing to be your teacher?
No, she didn't. She hadn't heard a single note. She was just the most kind, generous person. She's from Peru, and she was already playing with orchestras when she was 12 and was sent to study in America by the president of Peru when she was really young. Hmm. And so she was a classical pianist, but she was also a professor of classical piano at Manhattan School of Music for many, many years. I guess she just saw how much I wanted it, and she gifted it to me and my cousin. And she never, ever charged us for any lessons ever in our whole life. And just her and her husband they're basically our family for many years now. They might as well be related to us.
Let me get another song in from your new album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats, and this is Small Town Moon. And, you know, lyrically, what's kind of interesting about this is that it's not at all your experience. you know, it's about somebody who's from a small town and wants to leave but feels they can't. How can I leave without hurting everyone that made me? But it does make me wonder if your family felt that way leaving the Soviet Union.
I think that a lot of the time, I mean, I'm sure they did. I mean, I know that when we were leaving, we didn't know, for example, whether my grandparents, my dad's parents, were allowed to come yet. They were refuseniks. So they ended up coming to the Bronx about a year after we did. You know, when we were leaving, it was a very possible permanent goodbye. So I think, I'm sure, just like everything else of my experiences, it's in there. But I think one of the things that I love the most about songs is that you can connect with experiences, and it doesn't have to all come from your exact life. You can have empathy and you can put yourself in other people's shoes and sort of get to experience things and connect with people in a big way, even if that wasn't part of your particular experience.
Well, Regina Spektor, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Regina Spektor speaking with Terry Gross. Here's the song Small Town Moon off Spektor's new album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats.
I must have left 1,000 times, but every day began the same. 'Cause there's a small town in my mind. How can I leave without hurting everyone that made me? How can I leave without hurting everyone that made me? Oh, baby, baby, it's all about the moon. I wish you wouldn't have broke my camera. 'Cause we're gonna get real old.
Every year, tens of thousands of tourists from all over the world travel to an English village in West Yorkshire to visit sites made famous in novels written by the Bronte sisters. Biographer Juliet Barker was the curator of the Bronte Parsonage Museum for 6 years. In 1994, Barker released a biography of the Bronte family. A revised version of that biography has just been published, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's a monumental page-turner.
In the new updated edition of her landmark biography, The Brontes, Juliet Barker tells a sad story about Branwell, the infamous brother of Charlotte, Emily, and Anne. In 1834, Branwell began to study painting under a man named William Robinson, a member of the prestigious Royal Academy of Art. These lessons came at great expense, but what neither young Branwell nor his cash-strapped minister father Patrick could have known was that Robinson was a poor teacher. In fact, he failed to show Branwell how to mix his pigments correctly, and so the paintings Branwell did execute faded rapidly. Ironically, one of Branwell's clumsy efforts is now one of the most famous paintings in London's National Portrait Gallery. It's a portrait of his sisters, but because the badly mixed paint is becoming transparent with age, the delicate pencil sketches beneath, including Branwell's own face, which he'd rubbed out of the composition, are gradually reemerging. For roughly a century and a half, the Brontes have been the subject of biographies that, much like poor Branwell's painting, cover up more than they reveal. when Juliet Barker's monumental family biography of the Brontes was first published in 1994, it was as though a skilled restorer had come along to work on the group portrait, gently rubbing off the lurid colors of myth and gossip and revealing the bones of truth underneath. Now Barker has updated her biography, which has become the standard Bronte biography, with new material. The footnotes alone in this new edition of the Brontes run to 136 pages. It's rare that I have occasion to say this, but taken collectively, those footnotes are thrilling. Referencing sources as dry and diverse as the daily engagement diaries of obscure Bronte neighbors and ordnance survey maps, Barker attests to the fact that, with steady scholarly detective work, the truth of the past can slowly be approached. Anyone with any interest in the Brontes already knows the tall tales, which were first served up in novelist Elizabeth Gaskell's 1857 Life of her by-then-deceased close friend Charlotte Bronte. Living together in the isolated parsonage at Haworth, the Brontes were characterized as a 19th-century version of the Adams family. Patriarch Patrick was given to violent bouts of his Irish temper, randomly shooting pistols out the parsonage window. Branwell was a drug-addled roué, Emily a kindly mystic, Anne the shrinking violet, and Charlotte the steady survivor. Rather than stock characters out of Gothic melodrama, the Bronte children surface here as messy human beings, touched with genius, certainly, as well as mental illness, crippling shyness, and ultimately, given their early deaths, very bad luck. Barker's own original approach as a biographer in 1994 was to regard the Brontes as a unit. As children, Branwell, Charlotte, Anne, and Emily only had each other's company. Well into adulthood, they crafted elaborate stories involving imaginary kingdoms called Gondel and Angria. Barker traces how those absorbing fantasies, as well as the siblings' intense interdependency, fueled the creation of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights and the other novels. Barker also further redeems the reputation of Patrick Bronte, showing him to be a compassionate father and liberal-minded minister, and darkens our view of narcissistic Emily. Charlotte comes off as one of those tetchy authors better to read than to meet. As a teacher, she was prone to calling her pupils dolts and fat-headed. But that icy impression of Charlotte is thawed somewhat later in this biography, courtesy of a charming new letter that's been discovered. Writing in 1854 to a friend, Charlotte confesses to being talked into a white wedding dress, which she describes as plain book muslin with a tuck or two, also the white veil, being simply of tulle with little tucks. If I must make a fool of myself, the 38-year-old Charlotte wrote, it shall be on an economical plan. A year later, Charlotte would be dead. The official cause was exhaustion during pregnancy. She joined her siblings, who'd all died before her of consumption. Barker's updated and enthralling biography of the Brontes carries us deeper into the everyday realities of their strange world and elicits sympathy for their father, who alone lived on to old age and to witness the transformation of his family history into the stuff of lurid legend.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Brontes by biographer Juliet Barker. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, novelist Victor Laval talks about his new thriller, The Devil in Silver. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Victor Laval, writes fiction that connects with the issues that have defined him: a history of family mental illness, the rejection of religion and later embrace of church, a former eating addiction, and the attempts to find a place for himself in the world. He grew up in a multi-ethnic neighborhood in Queens, raised by his Ugandan mother, who was divorced from his white father. Laval's first novel, The Ecstatic, is about an obese young man who may be schizophrenic and moves into his parents' basement after flunking out of college. His second novel, Big Machine, is about a young man who was raised in one cult, then joins another. LaValle's new novel, The Devil in Silver, begins with a man under arrest who's being driven by cops to a mental hospital where he's supposed to be kept under observation for 3 days. Although he's not mentally ill, he can't get out. Adding to his fear and disorientation is the bison-headed monster that walks the halls at night. Terry spoke with Victor LaValle last Wednesday.
Victor LaValle, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a novel set in a mental health institution? I know because you've written about this that, you know, there's a history of schizophrenia and bipolar disease in your family.
Yes. There's a history of it in my family across many generations and on both sides of my family, actually. So I have a very intimate knowledge of the world of the mentally ill and of life inside of especially public hospitals, and the way people are treated in there and the way that they try to survive in there. And I wanted to write about it this time in a way that would allow readers who have no knowledge at all of what life is like inside there and even a certain degree of fear to understand the journey that the main character Pepper takes, because he too is not mentally ill, but he enters this place unaware and slowly becomes aware of the complexity of the people he meets.
When you say you've spent a lot of time in mental institutions, is that visiting family or being institutionalized yourself for periods?
I was never institutionalized myself. It's mostly been visiting those people who have been close to me or who are distantly related to me. But either way, I filled out a lot of visitor forms.
Now, one of the things that the main character experiences is that even though he's not mentally ill, he was brought to the institution by cops who he got into a physical fight with. Once he's given the medications, he just loses his will. He loses his bearings. He forgets that he wants to leave because he's only supposed to be there for a three-day observation to evaluate whether he is mentally ill or not. What experience do you have watching people on drugs that have been given for mental illness of one form or another that makes you think he would lose his will and his orientation and his sense of, I need to get out of here and here's how I do it?
Well, first I should say, as we talk about this topic, my family, I'm in many ways, I profit off the misery of my family, right, by writing these books and talking about these issues. And the sort of one thing I try to give back now, especially after they blew up at me about some earlier writing, is that I try to preserve some degree of their privacy. And I don't mean to sound evasive, but it's my slight way of offering them some degree of protection, even as I talk about these things publicly. But what I've seen multiple times is the way that people who are in various ways troubling, but also vibrant, powerful, smart, and active, begin their treatments of medications, whether it's one medication or as many as five medications. And within that 72-hour period, it is completely believable that they move from this person who is like a live wire in the best and worst sense of the word into essentially a dead power cable. It's no longer that thing that's coursing with energy.
In your novel, there's a buffalo-headed monster that stalks the patients in the institution at night. I'm wondering why you wanted to put a monster into your book.
Doesn't everybody love buffalo-headed monsters roaming halls? I know I do. the real reason I put that in there is because my idea of fiction is that it's different from, say, journalism, because journalism's job is to tell you what happened. And fiction, to some degree, is to make you understand how it felt. And the difference between what happened versus how it felt sometimes requires the fantastical or the impossible or the strange just to make you understand how powerfully an event affects a person. And so for me, the times that I've been in those hospitals, even as someone who was not even institutionalized at the time, I felt so much like I was in a haunted house. And if I had looked down that hallway for a week, for a month, for a year, at some point it would not have been that impossible to believe that I would see something rounding that corner something strange, something impossible, because my mind could no longer register the reality I was living in and started creating a horror that in some way symbolized the experience I was going through.
You also like monsters. I mean, you're kind of a fan of monsters in fiction.
I love monsters across the board, whether they're realistic monsters, like the awful parents of more realist fiction, let's say, or the awful husbands and wives, or the out-and-out Frankenstein, Dracula. Across the board, I love them.
Is there monsters that particularly scared you or appealed to you when you were young?
Actually, you know, the monster who I loved the most when I was a kid was Godzilla.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I saw that movie so many times.
I mean, what's beautiful about Godzilla is, of course, it's in every way a symbol of Japan dealing with the aftermath of the atomic bombs being dropped on them and their ideas of how they are affected by it. But rather than make a movie where they sit around and say, man, that was really rough, those bombs really did a lot of damage, they said, what did it feel like? It felt like a 100-foot-tall giant lizard came through our city and crushed it. And I really felt I understood that experience to some degree. I really connected with that fear and that power, because at times when I was a kid, I would say the chaos in my household, the chaos in my life, felt very much like a 100-foot reptile crushing everyone and everything.
There's some really beautiful and very moving scenes in Godzilla, like where all the children in the school are singing a song as they're surrounded by devastation and dead people, and it's actually a beautiful scene, even though Godzilla's a monster movie. It's really right. It's more than that.
Well, and that's I think that like the best. I mean, we're talking about film, but like say Rosemary's Baby is another one. On some level, Rosemary's Baby is about some lady who married the absolute wrong dude and then moved into the absolutely wrong building. You know? Like, that's all that movie's about on some level. But to add a little power to it, to make you really feel how much she's endangered, they say, let's throw in You're Gonna Have the Devil's Baby as well.
You have an earlier book called Big Machine that's about a couple of different cult groups. Why did you want to write about cult groups?
Well, I wanted to write about cult groups because I grew up in a family, and families are cults. Each family has its own cultish behavior. Growing up in an apartment building, I had the chance, we had, say, 40 kids in the building. I visited 40 cults every week, you know? And I would go into that place, and I would find out in this cult, you take off your shoes at the door. You walk inside, you say hello to the grandma, she serves you kimchi because it's a Korean family. And then you come to my house and you walk in and my grandmother has to sort of like pat you on the head and maybe she's going to tell you a Bible passage or two. And after I sort of came out of my childhood, I really felt like if you delve into the particulars of any one family, you will find in there a sort of faith, a set of religious customs that feel a lot like living inside a cult. And so when I started writing Big Machine, I sort of just wanted to amplify that. You know, the idea like real life is real life. It's 100% of life. But on the page, I find you have to amplify life. You have to write at 150% to make a reader really understand and feel the experience you're trying to write about. And so I transformed, say, my family into a cult called the Washerwomen. And the Washerwomen were three sisters from the South who had come to the North because they had murdered their families and were on the run from the police. And they started a cult in a tenement building, much like the building I grew up in. And their main sort of religious belief was that the Bible doesn't include enough black people in it. So we're just going to rewrite the Bible as if it was just nothing but black people and it took place in the United States. And they did that for the same reason lots of people sort of revise and update the Bible so that they would feel like this story was a story about them.
But why did you have the founders of this cult murder their husbands and children?
If I'm being totally honest, it's because as a child at least, that's what I felt childhood was like. Like it was a series of murders enacted upon me. And I wanted to just get that across. Of course, I know now it wasn't, but when I was a child, that's how it felt.
A certain degree. What did it feel that way?
I would say like the unpredictability of day-to-day life, even though it was a very, it's an incredibly loving household. I don't want to misrepresent my family, but day-to-day things could shift quite far. Someone who lived in the home might not be staying at the home for a little while because they were having some trouble and they had to go away. And someone else was going to take care of us for a little while. And this sort of cycling back and forth, it sort of felt like one shock after another. And to a kid, you know, 3, 5, 10, it felt like again and again being sort of one life has just been ended and a new life begins. And then you live that for 2 years. And then you start a new life because this person has come back and is doing better. And in that way, it just felt that powerful to me.
I don't know if I'm asking, if I'm going too far here. When people disappeared, was it because of mental illness or other reasons?
It was because of illness.
Mm-hmm. So you also write about ethnic diversity, and you are from a diverse home. Your father is white. You don't know him very well. He left the family when he was very young, when you were very young. Your mother and grandmother, who you grew up with, are Ugandan, and you grew up in Queens. You have a great description of Queens in your new novel, The Devil in Silver, that I'd like you to read.
Sure. Queens, New York, the most ethnically diverse region, not just in the United States, but on the entire planet. A distinction it's held for more than four decades. In Queens, you will find Korean kids who sound like black kids, Italians who sound like Puerto Ricans who sound like Italians, third-generation Irish who sound like old Jews. That's Queens. Not a melting pot, not even a tossed salad, but an all-you-can-eat, mix-and-match buffet.
Did you grow up thinking the world was like that?
Yes, I had a very mistaken idea of what the rest of the world was living with. I assumed that it was totally normal that you have a Korean friend, a Persian friend, an Irish friend, a Colombian friend, and then me, the half-Ugandan, half-white kid.
When did you realize that that is not typical?
We moved to another part of Queens when I was 13, and it was an all-black neighborhood. It was Rosedale, Queens, and it was all-black. We moved from an apartment into a house, and it was the strangest sensation. We would drive block to block to block, and it was just black people, black people, black people. And then we would cross the park, and we would go block to block to block, and it was just white people, white people, white people. And I said, wait a second, what's going on? And my mom said, we're in the suburbs.
So how did it change your sense of your own identity and racial identity when you moved?
Well, what it did was, so when I grew up in that really mixed part of Queens, and Flushing in particular, it didn't seem strange to me to be into a lot of different things, you know. And so in particular, me and my friends, this very mixed group of guys, were just all metalheads. We loved Metallica, Slayer, Iron Maiden. And I remember we moved into the new neighborhood and there were some kids across the street who I went to go play with. And I walked into the house and I have on a Slayer t-shirt. And it's basically like a pentagram made out of five swords. And there's a devil standing in the middle in flames. And then it says Slayer. And the mom of these kids just sort of sees that. A black woman, she sees that. She just looks at me just for like a full minute. She's just watching me. Like, And then she finally just goes, you boys go upstairs and play. It was the kindest thing, because I knew in that moment she was deciding, am I going to send this crazy devil-worshipping boy out of my house? Or can they go play? And she decided we could go play.
Now, in your fiction, you've written about addiction. And your addiction for several years was food.
For several decades.
Okay. Describe what it feels like to have food as an addiction. You know, you could give up alcohol and try not to go into bars or to go to parties where other people are drinking. Like, you can't stop eating. Like, you have to keep eating.
It's true. But what I would say is about food that is probably, I would imagine, very similar to a lot of other addictions, is that when you go into that mode where you are eating so heavily and so much, you're not actually enjoying the food. You're not even, a lot of times, even tasting the food. It's just your way of trying to hurt yourself, to destroy yourself, or to numb yourself. You know, in one way or the other, you're actually trying to negate the feelings you have with this thing. In my case, you know, donuts. So while it's true that everywhere you go you have to be around food, it's actually the impulse of self-destruction that you can't escape.
Now, is that something that you learned through therapy or a conclusion you reached yourself?
I mean, I knew even when I was doing it, like in college, when I was just buying tons of food and skipping class and just sitting in my room and eating, I knew I wasn't enjoying myself. I mean, I had friends there. I had people who would say to me, you know, come on out. We're just going to go do something. And I would willfully stay in the room and eat. And I knew that I was just trying to make my external self essentially reflect the way I felt internally. You know, I knew it at the time, but knowing it is not the same as being able to conquer it.
So how did you give up, like, addictive eating?
Well, if I'm totally honest, I sold my first book. I really don't mean to be flip about this, but I sold my first book. And at around that time, I remember I saw this episode of Law & Order. And, the two cops, whichever two actors were playing the two cops then, they go to a bookstore to look up the purchases of some credit card. And there's a sign there that says, romantic poetry by author so-and-so. And the cop says to the clerk, well, that must have been a real night for the ladies. And then the clerk, just in passing, says, like, yeah, 300-pound guy reading love poems. Like that, you know, complete sarcasm. But I sat there like, oh, that's what they're going to say. That's all that they're going to focus on, is that guy came through the door and read something. I don't remember what it was, but he was 300 pounds. And my vanity just kicked in. I cannot let that be the thing that they will say. I couldn't really save myself just for myself, but for my author photo, I could do it.
Okay. Victor Lavalle, thank you so much for talking with us.
That was my pleasure.
Victor Lavalle speaking with Terry Gross. Lavalle's the author of The Devil in Silver. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.